Okay, we're beginning here, four lines down on the top of Nun Vov Amud Aleph. Here we're discussing Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah's statement in the Mishnah that with regards to Tosevda Ketubah, the trigger for that is Nisuin and not Erusin. We had a machloke between Rav and Rabbi Natan as to whether Lacha was like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah or not like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The Gemara yesterday tried to attribute that to Rabbi Natan. Then the Gemara backed away from that because we found that Rav himself also subscribes to this concept of Umdina, and therefore we have no proof as to who made which statement over there. Now we're going to have a slew of positions regarding whether the Locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah or not. Yoti Rav Chanina Kra, Kamei de Rabbi Yanai. So Rav Chanina, the teacher of Mikra, was before Rabbi Yanai, Vikamar, and he said, Locha, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The Locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Armalei, so Rabbi Yanai responded to him, Poke, Kari Karech, Libora. Go take your psukim and read them outside, or basically stick to your expertise, which is Mikra, and don't get involved in Halacha, which is not your area of expertise, because in Halacha, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Halacha is not like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Amar Rav Yitzchak bar Rav Dimei, Mishum Rabbeinu. Over here, you have a problem generally in Shas. When we say Mishum Rabbeinu, who is the Rabbeinu that we're referring to? Generally, it's one of two individuals. It's either Rabbi, which usually we understand because we know he's called Rabbeinu or Rabbeinu HaKadosh in other places. Or it's sometimes used to refer to Rav, who is called Rabbeinu in Bavel. So Rashi over here says, Mishum Rabbeinu is Rav, because Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei was one of the Talmidim of Rav. When he said Mishum Rabbeinu, he said it Mishum Rav. Halacha Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, the halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The problem with that is, we just had a machloket between Rav and Rabbi Natan. One said the halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, one said that it's not like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And the Gemara was unable to conclude who had made which statement. Well, if you have this from Rabbi Yitzchak bar Rav Dimei, you should have brought this as a proof that Rav is the one who says that halacha ki Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So that's what Tosfot says. Can't be that the Rabbeinu that we're referring to over here is Rav. Otherwise, the Gemara would have brought that as the machriya between who said what in the previous sugya. The fact that the Gemara doesn't bring that means that Rabbeinu over here is not Rav, but rather Rabbeinu HaKadosh, it's Rabbi Yehuda Nasi. So therefore, it would not be a proof or would not be machriya in the previous case. But what about the fact that Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei is a Talmud of Rav? That he solves by saying, Nira, the Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei HaKadmon, Shaya Talmido, Shel Rebbe. He was Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei the first, the early one, who was a Talmud of Rebbe, who was the Rav of Rav. He was Rav's Rebbe. So I mean that there are two Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimeis. One of them is a Talmud of Rabbi, who is the Rav of Rav. And then there's another Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei, who is a Talmud of Rav. And so Rashi saw it as being Rav Yitzchak Bar Rav Dimei, the Talmud of Rav. But again, that raises the issue about the previous sugya. And therefore, Tosafot saw this as being the Rebbe of Rav and the Talmud of Rabbi or Rabbeinu HaKadosh. That's another psak in favor of Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Shmuel, Halacha ki Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So now we have Rav Nachman, the name of Shmuel, saying that the Halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, and that's why Tosafot on yesterday's daf commented that when we say that Rav holds of Umdina, that wasn't to the exclusion of Shmuel. Shmuel also holds of Umdina, but all we were interested in yesterday was Rav's position, but not to the exclusion of Shmuel. Shmuel also holds that Umdina works, because over here he says, Halacha, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. You can only say Halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah if you hold of Umdina. Rav Nachman Didei, Rav Nachman is a Talmud of Shmuel, quotes his Rebbe's position, but Rav Nachman himself disagrees and says, Amar ein halacha ki Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Halacha is not like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And Aradai, Mishmei de Rav Nachman Amrei. And Aradai, in the name of Rav Nachman, say, Halacha ki Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. That halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. So you have over here, Rav Nachman quoting his Rabbi Shmuel says the halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Rav Nachman himself saying no. And then the Talmidim of Rav Nachman Aradai, in the name of Rav Nachman, saying that the halacha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Vavagav, the lot, Rav Nachman, Vamar, Even though Rav Nachman cursed and said, Kodaina the dying Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, any judge who adjudicates a case like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, Hachi v'achi te'aveh, he should be this and this. And here they don't explicate on what the curse was, but he was not happy with people paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Filu achi alocha Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Despite that fact, the locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And now the Gemara itself comes and gives you the conclusion. V'alocha l'maseh. The way that we paskin is, Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. The locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Despite all the messes that we saw over here, the bottom line is, the Gemara says that the locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. And then you'll have to go back and explain the position of Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman's position might be more limited. May not be in all instances that he didn't go by Umdana. He only didn't go by Umdana in cases where we can find out the case. For instance, by a Grusha, where the husband is still around, then we can ask him what his intent was or what his feelings were. Over there, you can't go after Umdana. Versus in the case of an Almana, where the husband's no longer around, you can't ask him the information. So we can differentiate within cases where it might be true that sometimes we should not paskin like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah versus other cases where we could paskin. And Rav Nachman's position was simply stating, don't do it all the time. The locha is not always like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. In general, the locha is like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah that we use umdana dadat, and the umdana dadat is that we follow nisuin and not erusin with regards to the granting of the Tosefta Ketubah. Because it has to do with the bia or the chuppah, which we're going to see in a second, which is the bringing of the husband and wife together in an intimate way and in a way that is, in a sense, final. That is what triggers the inheritance of the Tosefet HaKetubah. And for that, we pass on like Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah. Bayi Ravin. Ravin asked, Nichnas al chuppah velo nivala mau. If the woman entered into the chuppah, but did not yet have biyah, and her husband passes away, mahu, what's the din according to Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah? Is that sufficient to bring her to the point where she now has nisuin, and the Tosefet HaKetubah is hers? Or is it biyah that is that threshold? Chibat chupa kone, o chibat biyah kone? What is it that triggers this threshold of nisuin, by which this din would be the case? Which is it the chibat chuba, the love of the chupa, meaning entering into his house, coming together, that's what generates it? Or is it literally the physical intimacy that generates that? Tashma, the Tani Rav Yosef, we have a bright, that brought by Rav Yosef, Shalo Katav La, El Al Chibat Laila Rishon, that he only wrote it, the Tosefet HaKetubah, for the love of the first night. I amart bishlama chibat chupa koneh. If you say that it's the love of the chuppah, meaning the closeness that's generated, the husband and wife situation that's generated, that's what makes him want to give the Tosefet HaKetubah, Hainu Damar Laila Rishon. That's why it mentions the first night. Eliyamart Chibat Biakoneh. If you say that the trigger is the bi'ah, the physical intimacy, bi'ah b'Laila Rishon Ita, Mikan Ve'elech Leita, bi'ah only takes place on the first night. Afterwards, there is no bi'ah. I mean, why do you limit it to Laila Rishon? And that could be from two perspectives. Why do you limit it to Laila Rishon? Because the Bia doesn't always happen on Laila Rishon, as we know from earlier on in the Masechta, as well as from the other perspective, which is that they will continue to live with physical intimacy. So why is it the Laila Rishon? It should just mean physical intimacy in general is what generates it, not necessarily the Chibat Laila Rishon. Velamai Chupa. So what's your suggestion that it is Chibat Chupa that generates the husband granting the Tosefet HaKetubah, chupa balayla ita biyomama leita? Wait a minute, chupa only takes place at night, not during the day. Velitameich, according to your reasoning, biya balayla ita biyomama leita. So according to your reasoning, you're going to suggest, oh, it's really chibat biya. Biya only takes place at night, not during the day. What does it mean, balayla rishon? Maybe it's yom rishon. Who says the biya is taking place at night? Ha marova. Rava says, this is part of a larger Gemara in the Gemara Nida, Imaya Babayit Afel Mutar. If it's in a dark house, then it's Mutar. The Gemara over there says that one should not have bi'ah with their wife, Be'yom, because Shemayit Ganeal Bala, that maybe he will find something unpleasant about his wife. When it's dark, You don't see all the little details. You don't see all the little things that might be a turn off. And at night, when it's dark, those things are not apparent. And therefore, there's a certain amount of protection of the individuals where there's not this type of scrutiny that would happen during the daytime. What the Gemara Nidah says is, if you can simulate night, then it's okay. So Rava's statement is just made. If you're in a dark house, that's the same as nighttime. And the Gemara there continues on to say, even if it's not a dark house, if you use the covers, there are ways to generate the same effect. You don't have complete exposure of the individual in the light. So we don't have to limit Bia to nighttime. Bia could be during the daytime. So again, why are you mentioning Laila Rishon? Where it says, Alokasha, Orech Aro, Kamash Malon. It's just telling us the normal setup, which is the Bia Balaila. The normal case, normal individuals, Bia is at night. And even at their wedding, the first night is the time they're going to have Bia. So it just talks about Balaila Rishon, which is the common practice amongst people. Elo chupa kasho. What are you going to do with chupa? Why does chupa have to be at night and not during the day? Chupa nami lo kasha. Kevin stam chupa le bia kaima. Since the point or purpose of chupa is to lead to bia, orachara kamash malon de balayla. So to over there, it's giving us what's the normal case. The normal case is you have the chupa right near the evening at night because it will be followed by a bia that night. Since bia is normally at night, chupa is also usually at night or close by or proximate to the nighttime. So it's just teaching you the normal course or what would be considered to be the proper conduct in these instances. By Ravashi, nichnasa l'chupa upirsa nida mahu. So now Ravashi really enters a secondary question here. The primary question was, is it bia, is it chupa that generates the threshold at which the husband gives tosefet ketubah? Where do we say that that love comes in and makes the husband want to give it to the wife? The Gemara was inconclusive about this, whether it was chupa or bia, even though from the Braita of Rav Yosef, it seemed like chupa was the better explanation of that Braita, still there were issues in both ways. From Rav Ashi's question, it seems like it's an imtim salomar. If you want to say that chupa is the generator of that threshold, then what is the din in this case? Which would mean that we're paskening chupa is the threshold. But then we have a secondary question now, which is Rav Ashi's question. If nichnasa lechupa upirsa nida, she enters into the chupa and then becomes a nida, mau. Imtim salomar chibat chupa kone. If you say the chiba of the chupa is what generates this granting of the tosefet ketubah, chupa dechazi lebia, that's only true when it's a chupa that will lead to bia, that's the case. Aval chupa delo chazi lebia, a chupa that will not lead to bia because she's a nida, lo, maybe not. Odil maloshna, or maybe it makes no difference. Chupa is chupa, irrespective of whether it can lead to bia or not. Teku, this is unresolved. What's interesting here, because of the layout of the Gemara, it actually leads to the Psak Halacha that is well known in terms of the Rambam, but also here in terms of some other Rishonim, which is, according to the Rambam, Chupat Nida ina chupa. The Chupat Nida is not a chupa whatsoever. So with the Rambam views, which is over here, Imtim Salomar, that chupa is the thing that generates the Tosefet Ketubah. So the Rambam, when you have an Imtim Salomar, the Gemara always paskins like the Imtim Salomar. He says the Gemara is now concluded. Then he's now left with the Teiku. When you have a Teiku, we paskin the Chumrah. So what the Rambam says is, yes, Chupa is the threshold by which all of these Dinim of Nisuin are triggered. Whether that is that he's allowed to become Tameh for her. Whether that is the fact that he's an Onain for her. Whether that's the fact that she inherits the Tosefet Ketubah. All that's generated by Chupa. But if you have Chupat Nida, no chupa, and therefore none of this happens according to the Rambam, and that's teiku, that is the chumra. Even other Rishonim that disagree with the Rambam and say that chupat nida is a chupa, over here they might paskin differently, which is that even though chupat nida is chupa, that's only for certain items with regards to nisuin. That's regards to onein, that he is mitameila. Those things are triggered by chupa and even chupat nida. What doesn't get triggered by chupat nida is the tosefet ketubah. Based on the same logic here, which is you have an Imtim Salomar, which says chupa is the trigger, but you have then a qualification that's left in a teiku, which is, does it have to be a chupa, a riyah, a biyah, or in a riyah, a biyah, and teiku goes to chumrah, which says that chupa nida even though it'll be deemed a chuppah in terms of marriage, it will not be deemed a chuppah with regards to Tosefet HaKetubah. And that would be the conclusion from the flow again of the Gemara here, which is you have an Imtim Salomar, and then a Teiku, which would be the Chumrah within that Imtim Salomar. There is a major machloket here between the Rishonim and then the Achronim afterwards as to when she became a Nida. Because the Lashon of the Gemara here is Nichnasa L'chupa U'pirsa Nida. And then she became a Nida. How literally do you take that Lashon? Does it have to be in this scenario where she entered into the Chupa and then she became a Nida? So she entered the Chupa Tehora. And that's what the question revolves around. Meaning that if she was a Nida before the Chupa, for sure... Now you can go either way. For sure she would not inherit, because there there's no chuppah. Or maybe for sure she would inherit, because then the husband already knows that he's entering into a chuppat nida, and he had that knowledge beforehand. But if it only becomes a nida during the chuppah, then he was, in a sense, believing this was a chuppah haruya labiyah, and then it got changed in the middle, maybe there it won't work. So you can go in all directions, and obviously that's what happens. The Rishonim are trying to deal with this issue of chuppat nida in general, and then chuppat nida, particularly over here, and maybe the difference between whether she became a nida prior to the chuppah or during the chuppah. But again, the conclusions that I brought you, according to the Rambam, that chuppat nida is lo shema chuppah, and for the other Rishonim who say that it is a chuppah, nevertheless, by Tosefet HaKetubah, we would still say that it does not qualify as a chuppah. And therefore, if the husband died at that point in time, she would not be entitled to the Tosefet HaKetubah, even though if she died, he, as a Kohen, would become Tamei for her and would be an Onain for her. I mean, we do Chuppah in many ways. Chuppah, the Chuppah like we have, then we have the Yichud, and then truth for the night, when they go home together. That's also Chuppah. Depending on what you think Chuppah is, whatever that is, that's what we're talking about. But if the basic concept of Chuppah is that the husband taking the woman into his house. That is Chuppah. Question of how you define it, when does that happen? Does that happen with the ceremonial chuppah that we have today, where he takes her into, supposedly that's his home? Is it the yichud room, where he takes her in and he's secluded with her? Or is it literally when he takes her home at night, to a place that is his? Which one of those is chuppah? That's already a machloket. But conceptually, the idea is that the husband's taking the woman into his home. And then there's the next piece, which is the biyah. So does it have to be a chuppah haruya lebiyah or not haruya lebiyah, which is the next stage of him taking into his house? Yigar Ketubah is triggered by Erusin already. Even if he died after Erusin, before Nisuin, she would be entitled to the Yigar Ketubah. Rabbi Yehuda Omer Ratza Kotev Libitula. Rabbi Yehuda says that we could set up a structure in which the husband grants a Ketubah to his wife, and the wife writes that she's Mochelet on a portion of it by saying, Hitkabalti, I received a portion of my Ketubah. Vesaver Rabbi Yehuda de Kotvin Shover. Since when does Rabbi Yehuda think that we use receipts in cases where a part of the loan was paid down? Vatznan, don't we have a Mishnah? Mi shepara mikzat chovo, person that paid back a portion of a loan that was outstanding. Rabbi Yehuda omer yachlif, they have to swap out the document or the credit document. Over here, the creditor is holding onto a document that says he owes 100. He paid back half of it, 50. It's not that the creditor gives the debtor a receipt for that 50. But rather, we're going to rip up the original contract and rewrite a contract for the 50 instead of 100. Because, as Rashi says over here, the Rashita of Rabbi Yehuda is, we don't want to put the Loveh in a position where, if he loses the Shover, then he's up a creek and he's going to have to pay back the entire amount. You're putting the burden on the Loveh now to keep the Shover and make sure it doesn't get lost, otherwise he's going to lose a lot of money. We don't want to put that burden onto the Loveh. On the other hand, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Yichtov lo Shover, he should write a receipt. As Rashi says over here, because if you swap out the contracts, then you're going to have a problem, which is he will now only have the rights of collection from the date on the new contract versus the first contract. So you've actually diminished the rights of the Malveh by writing a new contract now, because now his lien on the property only starts from the new date, not from the older date. Now, Tosafot points out over here with regards to Rashi's explanation of Rabbi Yossi's Shita, that's only according to the Hava Mina of the Gemara. That is not the conclusion of the Gemara in Bava Batra with regards to the position of Rabbi Yossi. The Gemara's conclusion there of Rabbi Yossi's position is, we actually prefer that the Loveh be under pressure. Because, yes, if he has to keep the receipt, then he's under pressure, because if he loses it, he's going to have to repay the whole amount. That is difficult for the Loved because he is like under a clock. He has to keep the receipt long enough that he will have it to protect him from being claimed against again. But on the other hand, if he loses it, he's going to have to pay a whole amount. What does that lead to? That leads to pressure on the Loved to repay the loan. And that's the conclusion why Rabbi Yossi likes this setup better, is because in the end we can keep pressure on the Loved to pay back without literally exerting pressure on the Loved. You don't have to be egos at the Loved. You don't have to put him under duress to collect from him. He's under his own self-duress because now he has to maintain this shover in order to protect himself from the repayment. The faster he repays it, the less of an issue this will be. And therefore it keeps the pressure up on him. Because Rashi's point, or the Havamina, was that when we rewrite the shtar, that he's going to lose the lien from the original shtar and then enter a new lien, all you have to do is date the second shtar by the date of the first shtar. You just write a new shtar that has the original date on it. And based on that date, because of the original shtar, it's not a false shtar, it's not a false lien. You're allowed to predate the shtar to give him those rights. So you can solve that problem of why we don't rewrite the shtar, you simply just date it from the first shtar. So that's why the Gemara there concludes that Rabbi Yossi's issue is something else, which is this pressure being kept up on the Loved. If it's fully paid, then you just rip up the shtar, and then there's no issue anymore. Over here we see that Rabbi Yehuda is against using a shover, using a receipt. Yet in our Mishnah, that's his suggestion with regards to the woman's relinquishing part of her ketubah. So I'm Rabbi Yirmiyah, kisha shovarta mitocha. That the shofar is written in the ketubah itself. So now this is not so clear how this works. Rashi writes, "V'tocha ketubah atzma." They wrote it inside the ketubah atzma, ketubah shofar. V'amra befanenu hitkabalti chetzia. That she said that she accepted or received half of it already. So that way, what the problem is with the shofar is we're afraid that the loved is going to lose it and then you're going to collect on him again. Here, you're not going to have that problem because the credit document, the document that allows the claim, has the receipt built in inside of it. So that the fact that it's in it, you can't bring out the document without bringing out the receipt as well. And in doing so, there you are protecting the Loved, in this case it's the Baal, from being collected against twice. So that's why when Shavarta Mitocha, then we don't worry about it. Now why this is only a solution by Ketubah and not by other Balei Chov? Why don't you say the same thing by other Balei Chov? So that might have to do with the way that it's done over here. In the case of any other Baal Chov, you will not get the repayment of the loan until a later date. So that means that you will have a document that is the credit document, and then you're going to put the shover, you're going to put the receipt underneath it. What could happen is if you put the receipt underneath it, there are two problems. One is the creditor can just cut off the bottom, and you would never know that there was a receipt written there. That's number one. Number two is, we have a principle of the Ge'onim, which Tosafot quotes over here, which is that you may not write something after what's called a Maaseh Beit Din. Anytime something is a Maaseh Beit Din, anything written afterwards is meaningless. Over here, the credit document is a Maaseh Beit Din. That's something that's signed by witnesses. It was possibly even upheld in a Beit Din. That's a credit document. Whatever's written afterwards is meaningless because any party could have written that afterwards trying to change the dynamic of what happened between them. So anything that's written after, it's meaningless. So by a shtar chov, by a credit document, there's nothing to do. On the other hand, by a ketubah, you could have a scenario where the woman, and that's the case here, is forgiving him up front. But she's saying, I received it up front. In that case, when it's shoshovarta mitocha, it's actually written into the core document before the signing of the edim. That solves two problems. One is that it's the Maaseh Beit Din ends after the receipt is put in. And number two is he can't cut it out. He can't rip it up because if he rips it up, he's going to rip up the core document. Or she here, if she rips it up, will rip up the core document. That's why this solution only works by ketubah and not by regular shtarei chov, because by ketubah is the only place where you have upfront an ability to put in a receipt that says I already received the money, because that's something she can do upfront. By a regular shtar chov, there's no reason to do that. Just write the shtar chov for the right amount. Why would you write it for the larger amount and say he repaid it? Because there is no such thing in the day one of the credit document. So because of that, the suggestion is brought here. Tosafot then says there may be other issues, which is what she will do is, you'll write up the document with the shover built into it. She'll just rip up the ketubah and say, I don't have a ketubah. She doesn't have a ketubah. Mitznai Beit Din, because of Takanat Chachamim, she's entitled to get paid out on her ketubah. even if she doesn't have a ktuba. So she'll rip this up and then collect her full ktuba. So then Tosafot says one of two things. Either she had an edunya. She brought in an edunya. Ripping up the ktuba is going to cause her a loss here, because when she rips up the ktuba, not only is she going to lose, quote unquote, the Tosafot ktuba, but she will lose now the nedunya, so it's not worth it to her to rip up the document, because the ktuba is worth more to her alive than it is dead, and therefore she won't have an incentive to rip it up. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that it's a place where we have the minag to grant a ktuba. In a place where there is a minag to grant a ktuba, she may not collect without a ktuba. If she says, I don't have a ktuba, we say, go bring it, otherwise you're not going to collect, because we worry about exactly this issue, which is that she'll come in and say, I collected based on the fact that I got married. She'll bring witnesses that she had a hinuma. Then she'll come back later date and bring out the ktuba and collect again. So places where the minog is to have a ktuba, she cannot, without witnesses, claim that her ktuba is gone. If she has witnesses that her ktuba was destroyed, then she can't collect without the ktuba. As Tosafot says over here, if she has witnesses that the ktuba were destroyed, those same witnesses can tell us what was written in the ktuba. Because if they don't know what was written in the ktuba, then they don't know that it was her ktuba that got burnt up. The only way they know was her ktuba got burnt up is because they saw what was in that document. So in that case, we'll have witnesses. So that's how Tosafot solves the problem as to why this will work over here, as opposed to, number one, in a case of a shtar chov, and number two is, in the case of the woman destroying the evidence of the shover, we won't have that problem because, again, Tosafot will give us a number of scenarios where there will be incentives for the women to keep the shtar alive. Abaye amar, afilu teima v'shein shoverta mitocha, it's even in a case where the receipt is not embedded in the ktuba. Bishlama hotam, over there, vaday pare. Dilma mirkas tavarta. Umepikle le shtara, vahadar gabe zimne achrina. What we're afraid of over there is, he definitely paid him. He made a partial payment on the debt. Then we're worried about the fact that the receipt that he's granted will get ripped up or lost. And then the creditor will bring out the document again and collect a second time. That's our fear. Hocha vaday havala? Over here, did he really give her the money? The way that it happened in the Mishnah is that she's forgiving him, saying, she's saying, oh, you gave me the money. He never gave her the money. She's just saying that in order to be mochel on a portion of the ktuba. The fact is, milta ba'alma hidamrele. She's just making up something by saying that I got the money. Inatre, natre. If he takes care of it, fine. Ilonatre, ihuda afsida nafshe. If he doesn't keep it, then he caused himself the loss. Because over here, he never really made the payment. Since he never really made the payment, the burden is really on him. Because she did him a favor by saying, yeah, you paid me, even though he didn't pay her. So in that case, when she grants him the receipt, he better hold on to the receipt. That's his problem, to hold on to the receipt. In the other case, the Lovay is really going to lose out. Because he really paid the money. He paid a portion of the debt. If he loses the receipt, he's going to end up paying the same amount again. Here by the Baal, even if he loses the receipt, he will only pay what was really owed by him. He's not double paying. He's just paying what was owed. He won't have that forgiveness that the woman granted him. But nevertheless, he doesn't pay in excess of what his obligation is. So over here, we'll say, yeah, let him deal with the shofar. Let him deal with the receipt. And if he loses it, he caused himself the loss. Abaye says there's a big difference in these cases between a shtar chov and a shtar ktuba. Bishloma Abaye lo amarka Rabbi Yirmiya. We understand why Abaye doesn't hold like Rabbi Yirmiya. Lo tani shovarta mitocha. The Mishnah doesn't say here that Rabbi Yehuda suggests that she writes him a shover that is included or embedded in the ktuba. It just says, ketav hitkabalti, she'll write that she accepted it. It's like a regular shover. El Rabbi Yirmiya, my time alo amar ke Abaye. Why didn't Rabbi Yirmiya hold like Abaye? Gzeira shover dehocha, after the shover dealma. Because he makes a gzeira that we don't like receipts here. Even though receipts here are not a problem, because if we grant receipts here, people will grant receipts in other scenarios, like credit documents, where it will be a problem. And since it will be a problem over there, we basically abandoned this methodology for taking down obligations by using a shover, because it's just a bad way to do it in 90% of the cases. Happens to be by ktuba, it might work, but if we allow you to use it by ktuba, then you're going to start using it by credit documents and other scenarios. Now the Gemara makes a statement. Taima de katvale. The only reason it works in our Mishnah is because she documents the forgiveness. Aval al peh, lo. If it is an oral transaction, then it does not work. So Rashi, as it explains over here, aval al peh, davi leitz na ba'alma, lo bi'avitz na, that it's only a condition. But Rashi differentiates here between the writing, the case of writing, which is considered to be a receipt, versus al peh, which is considered to be a condition built into the ketubah. So when it's written, you have two separate documents. You have the ketubah, which is full and whole, and then you have a shover, you have a receipt that says, I was in receipt of a certain amount of payment of the ketubah. So you have two separate documents, that works fine. Problem is, when you do it orally, where she says, yes, I received a portion of the ketubah, then what they're doing is not basically saying she is the equivalent of a receipt, but it's an oral receipt. She's basically now saying that there's a condition. This ketubah is granted with the condition built into it that she forgives a portion of the ketubah. And now you're basically attacking the core ketubah of alpeh, lo. And therefore, there's an issue. That's the problem when it's alpeh, which is that you built in a condition in the ketubah rather than having the ketubah and then having a separate receipt that is associated with the ketubah. Amai, davar shebim amonu. It's only a monetary obligation. Bishaminin le'er Rabbi Yehuda, damar davar shebim amon to no kayam. And we've heard from Rabbi Yehuda that you can make conditions or premises within a document that deals with monetary matters. When it comes to monetary matters that the Torah demands, you have a right to make conditions. Whereas when it comes to Isurim or things that are dictated by the Torah, you cannot go against the Torah and say, despite what the Torah says, I want this. That won't work. On the other hand, if it's Davar Shebe Mamon, it's a case where it's a monetary matter, which deals with parties coming to an agreement. Even though the Torah dictates the monetary matters, over there we say that, t'no kayam. You're allowed to make conditions that will change the monetary obligations that are associated over here. So again, if you view the issue of alpeh, being here that now you're creating a t'nai, rather than a separate document, which says I receive some of the payment, then what's the problem with making a t'nai? Rabbi Yehuda himself believes that when it comes to monetary matters that are dictated by the Torah, that you can make a t'nai. You can make a condition or embed a condition in there that changes the nature of the outcome. So to over here, you have monies that are embedded or obligations that are embedded in the ketubah, and she makes a condition that she's willing to accept it even without that payment. That t'nai, that condition should stand, because Rabbi Yehuda believes that it will stand. So why do you worry about it being t'va, our Mishnah, which dictates that it must be t'va? Why can't it be bi'al peh? Okay, that's the way Rashi explains it. You should know that there is an alternate view about what the alpeh over here is, which is that alpeh is problematic versus the ktiva, because alpeh will not carry weight versus the ktiva. Meaning that when you do something orally will not carry the weight of something that is nichtav. And so that's the question of the Gemara. How come in the Mishnah, when you write something down, it works? Balpeh, if you do it orally, it does not have tokif, it does not have power. Why shouldn't it have power? Because we see Rabbi Yehuda believes that you can make oral conditions and they still take hold. So not the fact that it's a t'nai is the issue. The question is that you've done it orally. And when you make oral conditions, the oral conditions are binding despite the fact that they're not written down. So you see that even when you do something orally, it is binding. Why do you have to write it down? So that's another view as to what the difference between t'va and balpeh is the question of tokif. Does it have power here to work? Is it only ktiva that works, or does balpeh work different than the way Rashi viewed it being balpeh? Is it t'nai versus ktiva, which is basically a forgiveness or mechila of sorts? Now, Tatanya, we have a breita. Homer lisha, areyat mikudeshet li, amanat shein laich alai sher ksut ve'ona. Guess what? We're getting married. There's only one little condition to our marriage. You don't have sher ksut and ona, all the normal obligations that a husband has towards his wife. I don't have any of those obligations towards you. Harizem mikudeshet. It works. Utna o batel. And the t'nai is ineffective. Divrei Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Meir's position is, you cannot be matneh amashakotu batorah. You cannot make conditions on things that are obligated through the Torah. So we'll see later on that Rabbi Meir believes that sher ksut anona are dinim deoraita, that are obligations mina Torah. Since those are obligations mina Torah, you cannot make conditions that undermine that which the Torah dictated. So here, that's what you're trying to do. What happens is your t'nai fails, your condition fails, and the Kiddushin go through. The Kiddushin are effective. Now that's interesting. You see there's a large Tosafot over here that deals with how does that exactly work? And the Tosafot is here, it goes all the way through the next Amud, which is Rabbi Meir is of the belief that every Tznai has to be like a Tznai Bnei Gad u Bnei Ruvain. That's basically the premise of the Gemara in Kiddushin, that there's a paradigm of how you make a condition. The paradigm of a condition is the din that Moshe Rabbeinu made with Bnei Gad and Bnei Ruvain. If you go over and you're Chalutzim Lifnei Ha'am and you go before the people, then you will inherit Be'ever Yardin. If you don't go before those people and be Chalutzim in the Milchama, then you will inherit with everyone else in Eretz Yisrael. So that has a number of items in it. First of all, Tznai Kodem Namaseh, the condition precedes the action. That's number one. Number two is, it's a Tznai Kaful, that it goes in both directions. If you do this, this will be the outcome. If you don't do this, this will not be the outcome, or the other outcome will take place. Well, if you do that over here, what he basically says is, if you accept the fact that there is no Sheikh Suto Nonana, we get married. If you don't accept that, we're not married. Then why, according to Rabbi Meir, does the Tanai fail and the Kiddushin go through? Over there, he made it clear. He stipulated that if it doesn't work, this condition doesn't work, we're not married. So according to Rabbi Meir, forget about Tanai Batel. Yeah, the Tanai is Batel, but so is the Kiddushin. There should be no Kiddushin whatsoever. Why are the Kiddushin succeeding over here when the Tanai fails? If he made a Tanai Kaful, which basically made it clear that if it fails, then there is no Kiddushin. So Tosafot is trying to understand why that is, and he says, "V'hashtu the alfinan mehani tnae the batela maseh." I mean, in dafka she'enu matneh mashakadu b'torah dumi b'nei gad b'nei ruvein. That's something ingenious. He says, "Yes, b'nei gad and ruvein are they basically paradigm for a condition?" Well, that paradigmatic condition was a case where they didn't make a tnae against the Torah. So their tnae kaful is a tnae kaful that's not against the Torah. You try to make a Tznai Kaful against the Torah, you know what it is? That's not a Tznai. Your Tznai fails. Not because the other side of the Tznai says that if it doesn't work, this doesn't happen. The Tznai is as if it never happened at all. The Tznai is not a Tznai. The condition is as if it doesn't exist, and therefore, the Kiddushin goes through, the action goes through, because as if there's no Tznai there. Right, Tosafot goes on to explanation by the Ri, which says, V'omri, Tom, Rina Matneha Masha Katu B'Torah, Tzno Batel, that only when you come to undermine something explicitly written in the Torah. In a case where you think that it's okay, or you think there's a mitzvah to do that, then your intent is not to be okay the davar sheba Torah. In that case, your tonight will actually go through, and you can accomplish it in different ways. He's bringing other examples from Shas in that way, but here Tosafot is slowly trying to redefine what Rabbi Meir really thinks in terms of Tanai is important, and then whether in Tanai Batel, does that mean that it's Batel the Gamre and the action goes through, or we reinterpret your Tanai and we make it work because your intent wasn't to undermine the Torah, but rather because you thought it would work in this instance. So all of these factors will make a difference in how we view the Tanai and how the Tanai affects the Maaseh, the action afterwards.
The Tosafot Yushanim actually quotes from the Rabbeinu Tam, and says the reason that the Tanai is Batel over here is Dehavi Maflig Bidvarim Ve'en Ze Tanai Kalal Shitkayim HaTanai. It's as if he's exaggerating. He knows that he can't do this. And it's some form of exaggeration where we drop the Tanai completely because it's so absurd that he's trying to do something against the Torah. And that's why the Kiddushin go through even though the Tanai fails over here. Tosafot, in addition, mentions that even according to Rabbi Huda, says that the Tanai works over here, it depends on how the Tanai is worded, which is that he cannot make a Tanai against the particular principle that he's trying to undermine. He can't say you don't get share suta no na, but rather what he can do, and when Tanai works, is when you're mochel, when you forgive the obligation. So what can be said is, if you forgive the obligations of share suta no na, then we will get married. What he can't say is, with the exception of share suta no na, because that's a direct statement against that which is written in the Torah, and that does not work. So the condition has to be worded in such a way that it looks like a mechila, a forgiveness of the obligation, similar to what she does here in our Mishnah. That's the way the Tanai works according to Rabbi Yehuda, and not any Tanai or any condition is able to uproot Davar Sheba Mamon. So what we have here is, according to Rabbi Meir, the Kiddushin go through, Tanai is Batel. Rabbi Yehuda Meir, B'Davar Sheba Mamon, Tno kayam. In a case where the condition is about monetary matters, the tnai works. So over here, which things are conditions based on mamon? Most of the Rishonim believe that share and kesut are the two items that are monetary matters. If you get share is mazon, kesut is clothing, those are monetary matters, therefore the condition is upheld with regards to share and kesut. By auna, which is considered to be her conjugal rights, that is a davar shebiguf, and there he can't make a condition. And the condition fails with regards to auna, and therefore he does not have to give her share and kesut, he does have to give her auna. There are those that believe that the ona is also a davar sheba mamon, because in the end it's hanat gufa. The benefit of the conjugal rights are the benefits or the pleasure that she gets from it. And therefore that is also a monetary matter, and he can make a condition here according to Rabbi Yehuda, even about the ona. Not just about the sharing tzut, although the rove or the overwhelming majority believe that this is only about sharing tzut and not about ona. Kasavi Rabbi Yehuda, ktuba derabanan. First of all, Rabbi Yehuda holds that ketubah is derabanan. Now, if ketubah is derabanan, none of this should matter because you're not matne amashakotu b'Torah. There is nothing written in the Torah if ketubah is derabanan. V'chachamim asu chizuk l'dvarim yuter mishel Torah. But once the chachamim establish ketubah, they give it more power than something that is in the Torah. According to Rabbi Yehuda, something written in the Torah, if it's a monetary matter, you can make conditions about it. On the other hand, with regards to ketubah, which is only a din derabanan, the Rabbanan made it even more powerful than a din d'oraita that you cannot embed conditions in it. Even though it's a davar sheba mamon, no conditions in the ketubah. And that's why Rabbi Yehuda does not accept that oral piece, either again, because of Rashi, the way Rashi uses the oral piece is a condition. Condition fails over here because it's a ketubah that has more power than it did in the Torah, and therefore it will fail. Or according to the other view, which is, yes, normally oral conditions can work, or oral statements can work. Over here, the oral statement doesn't work because Rabbi Yehuda gave such power to the ketubah that an oral statement will not undermine the ketubah in this case. Gemara says, is that really true? Vare peirot derabanan. Peirot, which are granted to the husband as a part of the tnai ketubah, she said peirot tachat pirkona, that the husband is obligated to redeem his wife if she's taken into captivity. He gets the peirot from the nichsei malog as quid pro quo for that. That's also a din rabbanan. And velo avdalu rabbanan chizuk. And over there, the rabbanan did not take away his right to make conditions in the fact that he won't receive the peirot. This is coming up later on in the Masechta, where an individual says that's not Rabbi Yehuda Omer. The olam hu ochel peirei peirot ad shichtov la dinu dvarim enli benichsech uperotehem uperet peirotehem ad olam. So over there, the Mishnayot deal with what happens if a husband says, I will not take your peirot. We'll get into this marriage, and I grant you the right that I will not take peirot. Or I will not take peirei peirot. What are the outcomes of that? So the Gemara over there talks about different possibilities. If he says, I won't take peirot, then basically what we do is, we take those peirot, we sell them, and we buy land with them. When we buy land with them, then that keren becomes the wife's keren, and he waived his right to the peirot. But then that new land has output to it. That's called peirei peirot. That's a derivative of the peirot that he is entitled to, because that's not peirot, that's peirei peirot. Then if he says, I won't take peirot, and I won't take peirei peirot, then what happens there? So again, then there may be a third derivative. They sell the first peirot, and then even the peirot the second time, and they buy keren, they buy land, and then the peirei peirot may be his. So Rabbi Yehuda makes a statement over there, that when he makes the statement in this matter, I have nothing in your land, your peirot, the derivatives of your peirot, ad olam, which means forever. No matter what, I have no rights over here whatsoever, then it works. Well, if it works, that means that he's allowing a condition, a monetary condition, to go through on the ketubah. The ketubah says he's entitled to it. V'kaimelan, my kotev. And over there, when the Mishnah says kotev, we didn't say it means literally kotev, it means omer, that he said. So kotev means omer, now this is an oral condition. So again, either we're seeing something that's done orally takes effect, or according to Rashi, here's a tnai against the ketubah, and the tnai against the ketubah is taking effect. Even though, just before you said Rabbi Yehuda gave superpowers to the ketubah, which says that there are no conditions that are upheld against the ketubah. Tosafot interestingly asked before, how come the Gemara didn't give that as the answer before as well? Why don't we say that our Mishnah means kotev, and when it says kotev, that means omer. Why is over here only? So Tosafot over there says, Tor korchach dafka kotevet nakat. Over here, clearly, kotevet means kotevet. Because it argues on Rabbi Yossi. And we're going to see later Rabbi Yossi says, Rashai means that you can make it orally. Which means that clearly Rabbi Yehuda, when he says Kotevet, means literally written down. Orally is not enough for Rabbi Yehuda. So it doesn't say it wouldn't work in the parts before. Over here it does work. So it's Omer. So Abai says, I have a solution. I'm Rabbi, the chol yesh ktubah, velo the chol yesh peirot. Everybody gets a ktubah, not everybody gets peirot. Milta de shchicha avdu ba rabbanan chizuk. In things that are common, the rabbanan gave superpowers to the ktubah. Milta de lo shchicha lo avdu ba rabbanan chizuk. Things that are not so common, the rabbanan did not give superpowers to the ktubah. So in the case of a ktubah, everybody gets a kor ktubah. Everybody is entitled to the ktubah. In that case, when the woman comes to make a tnai against the ktubah, it's going to fail, because the chachamim said that the ktubah is a much stronger document than you thought. And then when it comes to peirot, not every woman is bringing nichsei malog into the marriage. That's only true by wealthier women. That's only true by certain women. Since that's only true by certain women, the chachamim didn't create that superpower to the ktubah vis-a-vis the peirot. And therefore the husband can orally create a tnai or orally stipulate that he will not take peirot from the tubar, the nichsei malog. Where it says, wait a minute, v'rei chamarim dishchichei v'lo avdu l'rabbanan chizuk. What about the case of merchants that are selling, which is a common thing, and over there the rabbanan didn't again reinforce their din. Titznan, achamarim shenichnesu le'ir. You have chamarim that came into a city, v'amar echad mehem sheli chadash, v'shechaveri yashan. My stuff is new, his stuff is old. So again, we saw this sugya back on Daf Chav Dalet. Over there, there were numerous explanations brought down. One of Shem of Chadash and Yashan is, one of them is for before the Omer. One of them is from after the Omer. I mean, the Yashan was prior to the Omer. The Chadash was after the Omer. That was one answer. The Rashbam suggested that it had to do with Shemitah. That the Chadash was Shemitah. The Yashan was non-Shemitah produce. Rashi over there gave an explanation. And the Rabbeinu Tam agreed with Rashi and said that is the proper explanation over here, that Chadash and Yashan is not about a halachic issue. It's simply new and old, literally. His produce is older produce, which is now dried out, and therefore is more desirable, is more expensive, because when you mill it, it works, because it's dried out. My stuff is new stuff, which is moist. You have to wait for it to dry, and therefore it's worth less. So he's complimenting his friend's produce, and saying, mine's not good, his stuff is good. Shali ani mutukan. My stuff does not have shumot and masrot taken off of it. Shechaveri mutukan. But his stuff does have shumot and masrot taken off of it. Inan ne'emanim. We don't believe them, because we believe they are colluding. We believe that every city they go to, they switch. Who says what about whom? So in this case, A says this about B. They go to the next city, B says it about A. And they're basically tricking people into thinking that the other guy's produce is okay, and people will buy it. So they're colluding, and we don't believe them. And that is despite the fact that the Chadash and Yashan is something that's non-halachic. And even though it's non-halachic, and therefore maybe we should believe them with regards to halachic matters as well, the answer is no, we do not believe them. On the other hand, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ne'manim. They are believed. So over here you have a Dindar al-Bonon, where they're not Ne'manim, because here we're talking about Amay Aretz, and the din der Rabbonon that you have to be maser or mafrish trumot and maserot from demai, that's a din der Rabbonon. And we're saying that according to Rabbi Yehuda, they are believed. Why did the Rabbonon make a chizuk l'divrayim? Here it's common. This is a very common thing that happens. Why don't they reinforce their din? Amar Abaye, vadeh d'divrayim abdu Rabbonon chizuk. When we're talking about something that is vadai, definite, then they made a chizuk. Tuba is a definite obligation. There's no question here that the husband owes this to the wife. Over there, they reinforce the tuba in a way that you cannot orally undermine it, either because you cannot put a condition into the tuba, or because you cannot use an oral stipulation to undermine the written stipulation in the tuba. But they reinforced it there because the husband definitely owes the money in that case. Over here, safek de divrayim. The whole point of demai being mafrish demai is that it's a safek. Rov ha-mayaretz are masrin haim. This is a chumra de rabbanon that we take off trumot to masrot again, just to be sure we take it off again. But that's only misafek that you're taking off. Misafek, the chachamim are not going to come and then reinforce their din and say it's so powerful that we're not going to believe these guys. In this case, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and that's why they are believed. Safek de rehem lo avdu rabbanon chizuk. Rov ha-mayar bidamai hekilu. No, it's not that
Over here, it's a safek deretz avadai. Over here, it's demai. By demai, we have many instances where there are kulot, where there are leniencies that we deal with demai. First of all, you can give demai to the aniyim. Demai can be fed to the troops that come through town. We have many kulot that are associated with demai. This is just another kula by demai. It might derive from the same reason, which is the reason that we are makel by demai is because it's really only misafek. Roba me'aretz are masrim heim. So by demai ekilo, because it's only a chumra de rabbanan, and the rabbanan waived that chumra in cases of hefsid meruba, in cases where it would make a great burden on the city or the individuals, they might have waived it in those cases. This might be one of the cases where they waived it. B'demai hekilu, that we believe these individuals. We believe that they're telling the truth about each other's produce. It happens to be interesting that if you look back on the Gemara on the Chav Dalet, when we saw the sugi originally, b'demai hekilu was actually the shita of Abaye back there. And not Rava. Over here it's switched. You have it flipped around that Abaye's position is that he says the difference between Vadai and Safay. And Rava is the one who brings up that it is demai hekilu. Now, whether that's simply a Girsa problem that got switched around, or whether maybe over here, why he didn't invoke that answer is because maybe he's trying to create a bigger picture based on the statements that he made about the Ketubah and that over here. So over here, the reasoning of Demai Ekilu is not sufficient for him because he's trying to establish a principle regarding when the Chachamim Asu Chizik L'Divrayim and when they didn't do it. And therefore, he wants to give the answer that deals with that issue rather than B'Demai Ekilu. Now the Gemara says, Rabbi Meir Omer, kol apochet. Kol apochet, afilo bitna. Over here it says that Rabbi Meir says, anybody who reduces their ketubah is living with a problematic situation and it's bilat znut. So Gemara says here, kol apochet, afilo bitna. That even if he reduces it through a tnai, then it's a problem. Now, how the Gemara knew this is not so straightforward. How do they know that it's even by a tnai? So Rashi says, "Mitlotana kol abtula shein la matayim v'almanah shein la maneh arzu b'lo etznut." The Mishnah should have used a different language. The fact that it uses the language that it does shows you that etznai is included in this. Rashi basically establishes a principle here, which is if the Mishnah wanted to tell us that it's literally that there is a lack in the ketubah, then it should have written it with different language. The fact that it wrote it this way tells us that even etznai is included because basically, even if the woman gets paid out this money in the end, it doesn't matter. It's still a bilat znut, because the woman herself was lo samcha data. If the woman has any insecurity that she may not receive the money in the end, that's enough of a reason to call it a bilat znut. So even though if she gets paid fully in the end, the husband is still problematic and their living together was still problematic. It was still a bilat znut. Why? Because she didn't have confidence and security that she was going to get paid out on her ketubah. She thought the tnai went through. She thought it actually worked. And even when she gets paid out in the end, there's still a problem of bilat znut over here. Tosafot, again, back on Nun Aleph, explained why it is the case that the tnai, or why we think that here it is a tnai. But this is a discussion how we know that Rabbi Meir really believes by a tnai that this is also the case. Alma kasavar tno batel vidla. What Rabbi Meir thinks is the tnai falls away and she gets the full payment. V'kevin damar laich elamaneh. Since he told her you're only getting 100, lo samcha data. She didn't believe she was going to get paid out on her ketubah. Vavila bilato bilat znut. And therefore his biyah is a biyah znut. And this is what Tosafot discussed back on Nun Aleph, which is it's all about the mindset of the woman. Well, even if the tnai is batel, then why is it a bilat znut? That's what Tosafot asked over there. If the tnai falls away, then why is it a bilat znut? It shouldn't be a bilat znut, because if the tnai is gone, that means she's going to get her full ketubah. So the Tosafot said over there, based on this Gemara, that it has nothing to do with the payment in the end, it has to do with what the woman is thinking. If the woman is thinking she's not getting her full ketubah, that's enough to be called a bilat znut. The Chachamim deem it a bilat znut, because the woman herself is not confident and secure in her marriage that she's going to receive her ketubah. And ever then, back on Nun Aleph, when I discussed it in the Tosafot, I pointed out, that goes back to what we said earlier in the Masechta, this whole idea that the construct of the ketubah was to give a woman a feeling of security and a sense of security in the marriage that creates a marriage that's foundation is based on kedusha and security, and parties come into the marriage in a way or a manner that is wholesome. And because of that, that security or that feeling of security is so important. Doesn't matter that she gets paid out in the end. What matters is how she feels when she enters into the marriage. And therefore, if she enters into marriage in a case where she feels uncertain, or she thinks she's getting less than her ktubah, it's deemed a bilat znut, even if she gets paid out fully in the end. Vashmini and lay the Rabbi Meir, Darmar, Kolamatna Mashakatu Baturah, Tno Batel, Ha Bidrabanan, Tno Kayam. We know that according to Rabbi Meir, from the previous Mishnah, that if you try to make a condition on something in the Torah, it fails. But what would we dayeg from that? That's only true when you make a condition al davar shebe Torah. If you make it on a drabanan, it works. Over here, Daimak Tuba Drabanan. Tuba Drabanan, you should be able to make a condition in the Tuba Shirabanan. Kasava Rabbi Meir, Tuba Doraito. Rabbi Meir believes, Ktubah Doraita, again, this goes back all the way to the earlier part of the Masechta, about Ktubah Doraita and Machloket Rishonim, as to whether Ktubah is Doraita or Dorabanan. Even if you believe that Ktubah is Doraita, that might only be that the Ktubah itself is Doraita, but not the amount of money is Doraita. That might only be Dorabanan, or the other way around. Maybe that Ktubah is Dorabanan, but the money, or the amount of money is Doraita. All those different permutations we discussed during the Masechta, back in Tafiyud, there's the Tosfot over there that discusses it. But over here, you have this machlok between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yehuda. Clearly, Rabbi Yehuda believes Ktubah is the Rabbanan, and Rabbi Meir believes Ktubah is Doraita. The other question that is raised over here, which is based on the last Gemara, is that Rabbi Meir holds Ktubah is Doraita. Ktubah Doraita only applies by a bitula, by an almanah. Everybody agrees. Even if you think Ktubah is Doraita, an almanah is Ktubah is Midrabbanan. So how do you explain the Gemara before us? So you have to take one of two approaches. Either we're only talking about Ktubah and bitula, or you say that Ktubat Amanami Derbanan, they made it like a din Doraita, they are suchiziklu debrayem ki Doraita,
or as Tosafot suggests over here, core concept of Ktubah is Doraita, and there everything surrounding it will be deemed to be considered Doraita, even though technically a Ktubat Amanah is not Doraita. Tanya, Rabbi Meir Omer, kolapuchet betulami mataim uli amanami maneh, harizo bilat znut. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Rashai, he is permitted. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Ratzak Kutev Le B'tula Shtar Shel Mataim, V'i Kutev Elo Yitkabalti Mimcha Maneh, Ulo Amanah Maneh, V'i Kutev Elo Yitkabalti Mimcha Chamishim Zuz.
So here is a machloket, three-way machloket. We only knew about two of these opinions until now. Now we have the third opinion, which is Rabbi Yossi. We know Rabbi Meir's opinion that you're not allowed to reduce the Ktubah at all. And if you reduce the Ktubah, even on Yudei Tnai, it's considered to be a Biat Znot. We know Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, which is if you write it, it works. If you do it Baal Peh, it doesn't work. We just discussed that. And now this is how Tosafot says. We knew that before when Rabbi Yehuda says Kotev, it was literally Kotev, because Rabbi Yossi, here, his opinion says Rashai. You're allowed to make a Tanai. And over here, Rabbi Yossi clearly means Rashai, even Baal Peh. So it's clear that Rabbi Yehuda, when he says Kotev, he means literally Kotev. Otherwise, he's holding like Rabbi Yossi. He's differentiated from Rabbi Yossi because he holds that Kotev works, Baal Peh does not work. Rabbi Yossi thinks that even Baal Peh works over here. Amar says, V'savar Rabbi Yossi Rashai? Does Rabbi Yossi really believe that you have permission to make a condition against the Ktubah? V'ramini, Eino sim Ktubat Isha metaltalin mipnei tikkun olam. You're not allowed to have the Ktubat Isha collect out of metaltalin because of tikkun olam. Now, tikkun olam is a strange terminology to use over here. Gemara itself already somewhat deals with it. But Rashi says, Mipnei tikkun olam, shemi yovdu o yifchatu d'mehem. Maybe they'll get lost, or their value will be diminished, and therefore it's not a good idea. Now, we already know from the time of Shimon ben Shetach, when they established Ketubah, they went through all these different iterations. It was clear from Shimon ben Shetach that they didn't allow this to happen, because we didn't want the woman relying on specific items, because both sound chadata. She wouldn't rely on that, because it might get lost, it might get reduced in value. And therefore, there was a lien on the entirety of his property. So what type of tikkun olam are we talking about here that the Ktubat Isha can't come from metaltalin? It's already a fixed takana from the time of Shimon ben Shetach. It's not a din of tikkun olam over here. So what is the tikkun olam over here? So Rashi explains the tikkun olam is that, oh, maybe you'll lose them, or maybe they will be reduced in value. So what type of tikkun olam is that? She's already entitled to a lien to the whole property. So what you would have to say is that he gave these in addition to the total lien. He gave her this as the first right of collection, and then later on, if that doesn't work, then she will collect from the entirety of his possessions. So therefore, the tikkun olam is, we don't allow her to do that, because lo samcha dato. If she relies on the metaltalim, she really won't feel secure in getting her ktubah, and therefore it's problematic, and that is the tikkun olam that we're specifying over here. Amar Rabbi Yossi, Rabbi Yossi responds to the Tagna Kama, v'chi ma tikkun olam yesh bezu. What type of tikkun olam is this? Valo en ketzuvim,
Upochadim.
They're not a fixed value. Metalkalim go up and down in value. And pochadim. And they also diminish in value over time.
The Gemara says, Tanakama nami, enosim kamar.
What's Rabbi Yossi saying that the Tanakama also didn't say? Tanakama also says you can't use them. All Rabbi Yossi is doing is explaining why you can't use them. What is Rabbi Yossi differentiated from the Tanakama? Why is he arguing on the Tanakama? Elav achi kamar.
Bamed dvarim amurim b'shelo kibel alav achrayut.
But he doesn't have recourse on these items. But if he accepts recourse over here, then we would allow him to do it. Even if he accepts recourse on them, why do we allow this to go through?
Hello, ink tzuvim upochatim,
because they are not fixed in value, and they also diminish in value. What we're saying now, and Rashi explains this, is that the Tanakama believes that we worry about the fact that they might get lost. So now, once he has achrayut on them, we don't worry about it anymore. Ah, pochatim, the fact that they might lose value, that we're not worried about.
And along comes Rabbi Yossi and says, hello, ink tzuvim pochatim,
that they're not fixed in value, or they're not stationary in any way. And pochatim, they go down in value, so the achrayut is not going to help you with regards to the fact, afshim kayimin, ink tzuvim pochatim, even if they're still around, you still have a problem with these. So just because he's mekabel achrayut, if they get lost, that doesn't help you, because even when they're extant, they're problematic, because their value moves around. There's a fluctuations in their value, and that'll cause us a problem.
Tosu would ask over here, why don't we worry about what Shimon Shetach worried about with regards to, even after he accepted Kibbalat Achrayut,
why don't we worry about the fact that he's basically going to throw her out with the Kelim? One of the problems that Shimon Shetach had while in the iterations that he went through in the Ketubah was, when they escrowed the money, that the husband had no disincentive from divorcing his wife. Because he already had to put the money in escrow. The money was gone. So when he divorced her, it didn't cost him anything because he already had the money out of his pocket. So why don't we say the same thing over here? Why is there no disincentive for him to divorce her? Because she has the kelim already. The kelim already encumbered to her. He'll just say, you and your kelim, out of here.
So Tosafot over here suggests that the case...
Why is that different by karka? Because when the karka is encumbered to her, he works the land. He does everything on the land. Here by the metaltim are hers. He's not going to utilize them in the interim. What Tosafot says is that these are kelim hatzrichim lo. These are kelim that he needs, that he utilizes. So he's actually borrowing the kelim back from his wife, or he's taking the kelim and utilizing them. And if he throws her out with the kelim, he's out of luck then. He's really going to be up a creek. And therefore there's a disincentive built into these kelim. As opposed to what they were doing in the past, they were escrowing money or kelim that obviously he didn't need because they were setting them aside and he wasn't utilizing them. So over here, once he's mekabel alav achrayut, he's also, even if he's miyached the kelim, he's still utilizing these kelim. And then it looks like karka. Because then, just like he uses the karka that is encumbered to the ketubah, here he uses the kelim that are encumbered to this woman, that are miyuchad to the woman. And therefore, when he does divorce her, there is a disincentive to the divorce, because then he's actually lose out on the utility of these kelim. And that's how it's different than that which took place by Shimon ben Shetach. Where he didn't give her achrayut, if he didn't guarantee her recourse there, she wouldn't lend the kelim to him or let him use the kelim. Because she'd be afraid that those, he'd lose them or they'd get ruined, and then she'll lose her ketubah that were assigned to the kelim. So only once he grants her achrayut is she willing to allow him to utilize them. If he didn't grant her achrayut, she wouldn't let him utilize them because it's too risky for her to do that. Once he grants her achrayut, she'll let him use them, and once she lets him use them, then there's a disincentive from him throwing her out because he has utility from those kelim.
Hashto. Now, umahotom the dilma pachte. Over there, maybe they will diminish in value. Chayish Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yossi worries about a diminishment. Hacha devadai kapachto.
Over here where she's clearly diminishing the tuba lo koshkein, aren't we going to worry about it over here?
Hachayashtim. Gemara says the cases are not comparable. Hatam lo yada detachil.
Over there, when she receives the metalklim, she has no idea that they're going to lose value, or that's going to reduce the value of tuba. Over here, she knows about it, and she's being mochelet. She's a willing participant in the reduction of her ketubah.
Achte de Rami Bar Chama, habat nisiva le Rav Avya. The sister of Rami Bar Chama was married to Rav Avya. Irkas ketubata. Her ketubah got ripped up, got ruined, got destroyed for some reason. Atu le kamei de Rav Yosef. They came before Rav Yosef. Amalei, hachi amar Rav Yudah Mashmo, zo divrei Rabbi Meir.
That's the position of Rabbi Meir, that you need a ketubah. If you don't have a ketubah, then you're in violation of Bilat Znot.
As Rashi says over here, If Rabbi Meir thinks your pochet b'ktuba is problematic, then certainly if no ktuba at all, that is certainly problematic. And as Tosfot points out, the Gemara earlier said the fact that it's a tanai beitin that a woman receives a ktuba, the Gemara said that's a liba de Rabbi Meir. So Tosfot says it's either in a place where they don't have the minhag to give a ktuba, or even in a place where it is the minhag to give the ktuba, what Rabbi Meir might think is it's b'lilat znut, but she's still entitled to the money in the end.
That a person can keep a wife for 2 or 3 years even without a ktuba, because she's still entitled to the payout of her ktuba. You're wondering about the fact that it's a bilat znut? No problem. In the end, he'll have to pay the ktuba because that's a tanai beit din. No problem at all. He can keep her without a ktuba. Don't we have a principle that when Rabbi Meir makes the gzeirah, the halacha is like Rabbi Meir in gzeirotav, as Rashi explains here. But the varshu machmir al dvar Torah b'isur v'heter yedei gzeirat divrehim. In some ways where he is more machmir b'din Torah, because of gzeirah derabanan, the halacha is like Rabbi Meir. And that's what this is over here. This is a gzeirah of Rabbi Meir that you're now going to be pochet the ktubah. It's a din d'oraita, according to him, that it is ktubah is d'oraita. And we don't allow you to reduce the ktubah, or be mochelet on the ktubah. So here I have a gzeira derabanan that says that if you do such a thing, not only is the condition broken, but there's a bilat znut. So here where she's missing her ktubah, it'll be deemed a bilat znut over here. So he says, yochi zil kotuvla. If that's the case, go write her a new ktubah, because otherwise you'll be deemed a bilat znut. Okay, so we're going to stop here, 7 lines down on the top of Nun Zayin Omid Aleph.